The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Friends and neighbors, welcome back to the Bill Press Pod, and welcome to this week's roundtable. Coming to you this Thursday morning, July 17, around 8:30 a.m., just about the time Joe Biden's expected back in the Oval Office after returning home last night from his whirlwind diplomatic fan dance, bucking up the G7, romancing the Queen, reaffirming ties with NATO, and stepping into the lion's den with Vladimir Putin. Was anything accomplished, and how did Biden do on the world stage? Meanwhile, back here at home, except for the temperatures in the West and the Southwest climbing to record highs, things continue more or less at a standstill. While bipartisan negotiations continue on an infrastructure bill, many Democrats are getting antsy and ready to go it alone. Mitch McConnell vows to block Biden from putting anybody on the Supreme Court. And Republicans, led by Tucker Carlson, now float a new conspiracy theory that January 6th was actually an inside job engineered by the FBI. Yes, here today to help us sort it all out, Pema Levy, politics reporter for Mother Jones. Hi, Pema.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me.
All right. Welcome back. Jeff Dufour is editor-in-chief of the National Journal. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning, Bill.
And Alex Eichwald, back again, political reporter for MSNBC and NBC News. Hi, Alex.
Morning, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, let's start with the summit, of course, has been dominating the news for the last couple of days. The president held a news conference after Vladimir Putin had his news conference, and the president said, here's how I sum it up.
It was important to meet in person. So there can be no mistake about or misrepresentations about what I wanted to communicate. I did what I came to do. Number one, identify areas of practical work our two countries can do to advance our mutual interest and also benefit the world. Two, communicate directly that the United States will respond to actions that impair our vital interest or those of our allies. And three, to clearly lay out our country's priorities and our values. So we heard it straight from me.
So Pema, the big event in Geneva certainly gave the networks a chance to highlight their lead anchors and put on a good show. But otherwise, anything come out of the Geneva summit?
It doesn't look like anything big came out of it. I think the takeaway here is that the relationship between Russia and the United States is at its lowest point since the Cold War, and nothing happened to change that. There are obviously big things that stand in the way here. I mean, we're talking about Russia, which has, you know, through its cyber capabilities, attacked us repeatedly recently, including influencing our elections. And it doesn't look like there was progress on that front. So that's sort of an enormous elephant in the room here. That doesn't mean it's not worthwhile to meet and, you know, try to begin to forge a path forward. But, you know, Putin's agenda here at this point is very much his own agenda. You know, he's not necessarily clamoring to get back into the good graces of the United States right now. So I think that there's really a gulf here between the two countries.
Jeff Dufour, the summit, I saw the Drudge headline was no hostility, but no friendship either. I mean, was that what it was all about, basically giving these two guys a chance to size each other up and maybe even learn some respect for each other?
Yeah, and I think Biden played it smart. He's the fifth U.S. president to meet with Putin, remember?
Yeah.
And the fallacy, I think, of the previous four was to think they could accomplish something substantive Whereas Putin just looks at these as propaganda opportunities. You know, remember when he, you know, Bush 43 said he looked Putin in the eye and was able to get a sense of his soul. Obama struggled to get a word in edgewise at a couple of these meetings. And then obviously we know what happened with Trump. But Biden played it a little bit smarter, and he managed expectations ahead of time. He said, we didn't expect any deliverables, the White House said, which is a word choice that I really loved. And he refused the joint press conference, which Fiona Hill said this week that that's where Putin likes to make most of his mischief. And afterward, you had the mostly platitudes, like we heard from Biden, reaffirming NATO, saying cyber attacks would be met with like-minded attacks. So the bottom line, I think, is Biden didn't play Putin's game the way his predecessors did, and that might be enough to call it a win, at least politically, on the world stage.
Well, Alex, there is a big domestic audience for this, too, of course. How does this help Biden, or does it help Biden politically?
Well, I mean, the bar was so low for him going into this. Like with so much of his presidency, where compared to his predecessor, Donald Trump, just by doing kind of the basics that, you know, we have expected from presidents, from many presidents, both parties before Trump, just by returning to that kind of normal sense of, you know, not siding with the Russian president over your own intelligence agencies and the FBI, as Trump did in Helsinki. You know, he gets some points for just kind of doing what we would have considered the most basic job in the past. But, you know, politically, I don't know that there's like a lot of upside potential. There's a lot of downside potential that I think he mitigated fairly effectively. You know, there's still a large chunk of the Republican Party that, despite the years of Trump, is still very skeptical of Russia and is eager to blame Democrats for being too soft on Russia, as they did for Obama. And there's a lot of Democrats who, you know, think Putin is swung the 2016 election, is kind of evil. So, you know, he wants to try to make some kind of progress, cut some kind of deals, but he has to do it without looking like he's being too friendly to Putin or giving too much ground to Putin. So I think, yeah, the optics here, meeting in Geneva, not meeting in Russia, not doing the joint press conference. I think this the win is to not mess up, and I think he gets a points for doing that.
Yeah, Pamela, what about that not having a joint news conference? Some people said that some Republicans criticized Biden, just saying it showed that he was too weak. He was afraid to appear side by side with Putin. Was that a smart move on Biden's part, or a mistake?
I think it was a smart move on Biden's part. I mean, look, there's nothing that Biden can do that would mean that no Republicans have a way to criticize him for it, right? I mean,
yeah,
they are right. The opposition party here. So, you know, they will, you know, he can be too friendly, he can be too soft, he can be too mean, you know, whichever direction they want to take it, they can. But, you know, I definitely agree with Jeff and Alex. I mean, there's a tricky dance here, I think, you know, particularly with Democrats, but also with some Republicans who want a more hard line against Russia, right? Which is, you know, even by going ahead and meeting with him, you know, even by shaking his hand, you are sort of giving him the benefit of the doubt after years of what have been like really destructive Russian intervention in this country. And so I think, you know, even agreeing to this one-on-one meeting and, you know, trying to hash out, you know, goals going forward, is on some level could be seen as soft, right? Could be seen as conciliatory to someone who does not certainly have the best interests of the United States at heart. So I think that by not doing the joint press conference, you're still distancing yourself from that person and sort of saying, you know, we're moving slowly here. We might be rebuilding trust, but we're not ready for the joint press conference yet. And I think that was the right move, even if, you know, if a small number of people can find a way to criticize him for it.
Right. And as we know, the big news that came out of Biden's news conference was not the news conference itself, but the question that was shouted at him as he walked away from the podium. Rule number one, when you walk away from the podium, keep going. Don't turn around and answer that shouted question. But that question came from Caitlin Collins from CNN. Here it is, and Biden's response.
Why are you so confident he'll change his behavior, Mr. President?
Yeah, I'm not confident. What do you do all the time?
So what
said I was confident.
I said,
let's get it straight. I said, what will change their behavior is the rest of the world reacts to them and it diminishes their standing in the world. I'm not confident of anything. I'm just stating the fact.
So a pretty pissy response. Jeff, was it a fair question?
It was a fair question, but to your point, Biden can't engage like that. I'm sure he was tired. I'm sure he thinks it's 2 o'clock in the morning when it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon or what have you.
Yeah.
And then later he did say he apologized. He said, I want to apologize to the reporter. I was a wise guy. He was the typical avuncular Biden response. But I watched a little bit of Fox last night, and that's exactly what everyone is going to seize on. That he lost his temper here. He can't handle a simple question from a reporter. And by the way, Fox News was really something last night. To watch it, you would have thought that Biden had just given away the store to Vladimir Putin. That he had given Putin the keys to the nuclear codes. It's a sad day for America. Nothing will ever be the same again. Seriously, which the contrast for 4 years ago, it's really remarkable that they would say that. But nevertheless, that's where we are.
Yeah. Alex, I've always felt as a White House reporter myself that there's no such thing as an unfair question, right? Anything goes. I thought she asked a fair question, and I guess even Biden has a right to get pissed off once in a while. But it is unusual to see a president, A, get pissed off, and B, apologize so soon afterwards.
Yeah, it's definitely unusual. It's very Joe Biden. I mean, he does have a temper that is kind of like lurking right underneath the surface of that avuncular personality. And I remember seeing him, in Iowa on the campaign trail, doing something like this. There's one time in particular that stands out. Ed O'Keefe from CBS mm-hmm. asked him something. I think it was a day when Hunter Biden was in the news, and he kind of came back kind of mocking Ed O'Keefe's question and then later apologized for it, a similar thing. So, I think every president has probably had a moment where they want to say something like Joe Biden did. Every senator, any public official who gets questions from reporters, even if they're fair, I'm sure they have to bite their tongue all the time. And in this case, he just did not succeed in biting his tongue, which is, that's not good. I mean, we want our presidents to treat the press respectfully, but it would give him credit for coming back and cleaning it up later. It's the kind of thing where, I don't think this is going to affect White House press relations in the long term, because it's the kind of thing that I think everybody understands that that's probably what they say privately. He just said it publicly this time.
Well, my favorite part of the whole summit was that Joe Biden gave Vladimir Putin a pair of aviator sunglasses. So there they are. They are brothers in aviator sunglasses from now on. Let's coming back here at home, where to say the least, the tension on Capitol Hill and the hostility on Capitol Hill is very real and palpable. John Barrasso, senator from Wyoming, may be speaking for a lot of his colleagues, Republican senator from Wyoming, kind of summed it up this week and how they feel about working together with Joe Biden.
Mitch McConnell's come under a lot of criticism for saying at one point he said he wanted to make sure that Barack Obama was a one-term president. I want to make Joe Biden a one-half-term president.
I'm not sure how we do that, a one-half-term president. But Pema, does this mean, let's start with infrastructure, that getting anything done in a bipartisan way is out of the question?
Well, I don't know if it's out of the question, but I do think it really puts a point on whether or not Republicans are going to really come to the table in good faith here, and whether or not it's worth Democrats' time to be doing what they're doing, which is, pursuing a bipartisan infrastructure deal. I think there are a handful of Republicans that are probably at this in good faith because they are attending these meetings and part of developing a bipartisan deal. That deal is a very far cry from what Biden initially proposed. And I think that, and it's taken months, right? And we're nowhere close to figuring out what is going to ultimately happen, if anything. So, you know, I think what I take from Barrasso's point here is they're kind of already doing it, right? I mean, if the point is just like, we don't want anything to happen and then we want to win in the midterm so that he's basically a lame duck for the last 2 years, you know, stalling in Congress on his, you know, major policy proposals is the way to do it. So, I mean, I think this is not a surprise. And I think this is where you see a lot of frustration from the left, which is, why are we negotiating on something that's like a quarter of what we mm-hmm. wanted? It leaves out, you know, so many of our big priorities in terms of, you know, everything from like childcare to the environment, right, is off the table in these talks. And I think you're also seeing, you know, again, to Barrasso's point here, you're actually seeing his strategy work, because there's actually polling out saying Biden's popularity has taken a hit, Congress's popularity has taken a hit, right? I mean, sort of the longer these things go on, the more people think, oh, you know, Biden can't get anything done, Washington can't get anything done. So, you know, it's definitely in Republicans' interest to sort of drag out these talks as much as possible.
Well, Jeff, the first Republican proposal attempt to reach an agreement with the Biden administration under Shelley Marcapeto from West Virginia failed. But this bipartisan group of senators and their proposal, I saw this morning, they're now up to 21 senators,
yeah,
10 Democrats and 11 Republicans supporting it. So I understand Pema's point, but maybe there is a glimmer of hope here.
It's exceeding my expectations at the moment. Let's underline at the moment, because there's a long way to go. The key is if they can get the leaders on board. John Thune seems to be interested. If they can get Schumer and McConnell with a little, not to say necessarily that they would even whip the vote, but if they can get them interested and not kill it, if they can pull this off, it would be beyond anybody's expectations in terms of a bipartisan victory in this kind of climate. And that's exactly why I remain skeptical, really. Because then look down the line, it really forces the House to assemble a similar type of coalition. You've got the folks on the left who are never going to go for it. In the Senate, you've got not just Sanders and Markey, but Martin Heinrich from New Mexico came out against this yesterday because there's not enough environmental commitments. And the folks on the right who think that suddenly they have religion on deficits and they think it's too expensive. You're going to see the exact same thing in the House. And there you're going to get even less Republican buy-in because, and maybe even less progressive buy-in because the each one of the ideological wings are more numerous and more vociferous in their objections. So you might be able to assemble this coalition in the Senate. I'm skeptical that you can assemble it again in the House.
Right. And Alex, this whole deal does seem to hinge on, which many progressives are saying, Democrats are saying, also on a follow-up bill, right? A second bill, which will have all the stuff that's taken out of this on climate change and childcare and other stuff in it. And the Democrats saying they're not going to pass with this bipartisan compromise unless they're sure the follow-up is coming along. Right.
Right. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation because, I've heard arguments made on either way. One argument is, well, just take this while you can and then, you know, try to get the tougher stuff, which is all the stuff you're talking about, the human infrastructure, yeah, so to speak, mm-hmm, the climate change. Try to get that later, but just take the bird in the hand now. But then the counter argument to that is, well, all that stuff is the harder stuff to pass. So why would you separate it and make it a standalone bill? Instead, you know, fold it into the more popular traditional infrastructure stuff and force Joe Manchin and Sinema and, you know, the other moderate Dems to take a vote on the whole thing all at once. So that's the kind of, I think, the big strategic question right now that the White House and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi face is, do they, if this bipartisan deal is real, and it does seem like there's more forward motion on it than some of the other recent deals. If it's real, do they take it and risk the other stuff, the human infrastructure stuff, or do they say no deal and you know, try to roll it all together? Mm-hmm. My guess is if they really can get the bipartisan deal, they'll take it, even if it means sacrificing the other stuff.
Yeah. Jeff, let me come back to you for just a sec, because the other big issue on the table is voting rights. Joe Manchin sort of stunned everybody last week by saying there's no way I'm going to vote for the For the People Act. But now he's come out with a compromise that he's proposing. Here is what I will vote for and what I'd like to see in a Voting Rights Act. Does that raise your expectations for some kind of a Voting Rights Act to get through the Senate?
Potentially. I have to hedge on this stuff, because I remain skeptical about anything big getting through this Congress. I was truthfully surprised that the For the People Act was pushed seriously as a piece of legislation in this Congress. Because remember, it was written, 3 or 4 years ago as a messaging bill. For Democrats to essentially make the point and give them something to run on. And now all of a sudden it's become something that they're trying to pass. It's a much bigger and more ambitious bill than, say, the John Lewis Act, which is much more tailored. So I think there does seem to be a critical mass of members who are amenable to something like the John Lewis bill. And if they can join forces with Manchin, maybe there's a path. But again, I'll believe it when I see it, put it that way.
And it looks like Manchin is trying to say, look, I'm not totally against voting rights. I'm not going to vote for the big bill, but here's what I can vote for. And
maybe the big bill has some issues with federalism. A lot of it would end up going to the courts. In terms of overruling state election law. So there are some real concerns there.
Yeah. At the same time, all of us are skeptics, but Congress, maybe defying our skepticism, did actually pass something overwhelmingly this week, a new federal holiday. Let's talk about that with our panel, Pema Levy, Jeff from Mother Jones, Jeff Dufour, National Journal, and Alex Seitzwald, MSNBC and NBC News, after we take a quick break here on the Bill Press Pod. And today's roundtable brought to you by the Iron Workers Union, those good men and women, over 500,000 strong of the iron workers under President Eric Dean. They are building America's roads and buildings and bridges today and ready to rebuild America's infrastructure tomorrow if, as we just discussed, Congress ever gets its act together. They are the people who have built some of our most iconic structures in this country, including the Golden Gate Bridge, the St. Louis Arch, the New World Trade Center, and a whole lot more. Check out their website at ironworkers.org, and we thank the members, the good men and women of the Iron Workers, for their support of the Bill Press Pod.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
And we're back. Today's panel joining us, Alex Seitzwald from NBC News, Jeff Duffer of the National Journal, Pema Levy on Mother Jones. So Pema, despite all the skepticism about Congress ever doing anything, they rallied the Senate passing unanimously legislation to create a new national holiday, Juneteenth, a bill which President Biden is going to sign this afternoon at the White House, the first national holiday, new national holiday since 1983, particularly significant at this time to create Juneteenth as a national holiday, Pema, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really good acknowledgement of some of the lessons that we have collectively learned here over the past couple of years, and, you know, particularly after last year with the death of, or I should say murder of George Floyd and the protests over racial inequality and police violence that came out of that. I think it is really important. My only sad point of this, which really I do believe is sort of a, we can celebrate this as a nice high watermark, something we've actually accomplished here, is at first I was sort of like, oh, this is so great because now they're going to teach it in school and say, ah, here's why you have the day off. And, you know, we'll learn more about, you know, the end of slavery and emancipation. And then a friend pointed out like, well, actually most people are already out of school at this point, so we might not actually teach it. And I was like, oh, that's really a bummer. But other than that, I think we can finally say, you know, Congress did the right thing here. And I think that, I hope that it doesn't just mean, and another day off for people who, you know, work regular, you know, salaried jobs. But it actually comes with some sort of education or way to, you know, rethink our past and grapple with the legacy of slavery and even sort of the slow and horrific way it came to an end. I hope that part of the work comes next, but making it a national holiday is a good first start.
A good point. And Alex, the downside of this, I guess, is that 14 Republicans voted against making Juneteenth a national holiday, and it's also this week, 21 Republicans voted against giving a gold medal to the Capitol police officers who defended them with their lives, some of them, on January 6th. Is there an element of the, even Jim Jordan did not vote with them, I must tell you, right? So my question, is there a little coalition of this Freedom Caucus that's gotten so extreme that they're just totally out of step with the American people, and doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't think it's really going out too far on a limb to say yes to that. If by the American people you mean all of the American people, because I think they see themselves as representing not even just the Republican Party, but a segment of the Republican Party. The way former President Trump would always talk about it. On the Juneteenth, I think it's there's an interesting labor angle here too, which I've heard some folks make, which is there's a lot of people who would obviously love to see more paid time off, family leave, all that stuff, and that not that this is any kind of replacement for it, but it is kind of a backdoor way in to give workers more time off, is to create more federal holidays. I think people like not having to work. So even if you don't necessarily agree with this particular holiday, it is kind of surprising to vote against, you know, a day off of work. But on the Capitol Police, I think what's going on there and on January 6th is that this is the mainstream of the Republican Party has realized that there's no way to reconcile what actually happened on January 6th with continuing to embrace Trump and his, you know, what's been called the big lie about the 2020 election. You can watch this cognitive dissonance play out in real time. So they have to find some way to say it's okay to keep Trump around and to continue to perpetuate these falsehoods about the 2020 election. How do we incorporate January 6th into that? Well, just deny that it happened, or deny that it was Trump supporters, or blame somebody else, or say it was left-wing agitators, or say they were just tourists in the Capitol. It wasn't that bad. And, you know, pick your flavor, but they're all kind of coming up with their own way to downplay, to deny the reality of what actually happened on January 6th. I think because you just can't accept what happened there and continue to push the other falsehood about the 2020 election and Donald Trump's claims.
Well, and as an illustration of how far it seems some on the right will go, as Alex pointed out, to downplay January 6th. Jeff, this was Tucker Carlson this week on his show with a whole new conspiracy theory about what really happened on January 6th. Here's Tucker.
The events of January 6th that you keep hearing about endlessly, events that Democrats in Congress describe as an act of war carried out by white supremacists, as dangerous and historically significant as Pearl Harbor and 9/11. Those events apparently were at least in part organized and carried out in secret by people connected to federal law enforcement. It's hard to think of a bigger potential scandal than this one.
Those events on January 6th, potentially carried out by people in federal law enforcement. He was talking about the FBI. Jeff, anything goes these days, I guess?
Sure. And before I get to Tucker, I'm going to go back to the Capitol Police for a second.
Yeah, sure.
It just broke this morning that D.C. police officer Michael Fanone, who was beaten unconscious on January 6th, now says this week he was in an elevator with Congressman Andrew Clyde from Georgia,
right,
who was one of the 21, and Clyde refused to shake his hand even after he introduced himself. So this is what we're dealing with there. But back to Tucker. I mean, if you give any act of violence long enough, it becomes a false flag operation. First, as Alex said, first it was undercover Antifa, then it was just a bunch of peaceful folks, not much different from tourists. Now it's undercover FBI agents pulling the puppet strings. Which, you know, help me understand this. In other words, the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, none of them would have done this were it not for the G-men egging them on in the background. Is that the suggestion? Now, of course, he's wrong on the law. Plenty of prosecutors have come out and said federal law doesn't permit undercover agents, cooperating witnesses, informants, etc., to be charged with conspiracy. It's not something that's permitted by the DOJ. And I would also point out there's a host of reasons somebody might not be charged in a conspiracy case. Trump himself wasn't charged with obstruction because of a superseding legal principle. Sometimes people aren't charged because the government's still building its case against them, or because they've struck a deal to testify after the fact. Yet, like so many things we see, it goes from the conspiracy fever swamps of the internet to Molly Hemingway, to Tucker, to Marjorie Taylor Greene, who spouted off about it yesterday, in the course of 24 hours. And there's your news cycle of crazy right there.
Right. You know, I remember, it reminds me of the wacky conspiracy after 9/11 that it was all an inside job, you know, engineered by Dick Cheney or by the CIA or somebody, right? And at the time, that was so crazy. As I remember, I was doing talk radio at the time. People would call in, you know, we would just hang up on them. We wouldn't take their calls. We wouldn't put them on the air. And now this is equally insane. And yet as you point out, Jeff and the others, it's in the mainstream media, even, right, is talking about it. Crazy. Well, let's go to the Supreme Court. Came up again this week. Mitch McConnell appearing on Hugh Hewitt's radio show and defiantly saying, Merrick Garland, you thought that was bad? I'd do it all over again. Here he is.
I don't think either party, if it controlled, if it were different from the president, would confirm a Supreme Court nominee in the middle of an election.
So there you go, Pema. Mitch McConnell seems to change his mind depending on whether it's a Republican or a Democratic president in the Oval Office.
Yeah, I don't think that, you know, even Mitch McConnell really cares to be consistent here, I think. Right. I mean, he kind of relishes his reputation here as this is about power and this is about getting our people on the Supreme Court and about winning elections.
Period.
And period. Right. And that's what he's going to do. And, you know, I think, you know, back to what we were talking about before with infrastructure, I think this is where there's so much distrust on the left here, which is, you know, they want to make our presidents one-term presidents and they want to get their people in the Supreme Court and they're just going to act in their self-interest. So why are we bending over backward here to accommodate them? But yeah, I mean, you know, don't be surprised if there's a replay of, you know, what happened with Justice Scalia's seat in the next few years.
Oh, absolutely. Could this backfire by motivating Democrats to really turn out in greater numbers in the midterms?
It's possible, but at least historically, Republicans have been more likely to vote based on the Supreme Court and the judiciary and judges than Democrats have in the past. And I think Democrats have had a harder time explaining to their voters the importance of the courts, have had a harder time making the issue salient. I mean, you know, the Merrick Garland seat was left open during the entire 2016 election, and it was not really... It was a thing that Hillary Clinton would talk about sometimes, Barack Obama would talk about sometimes, but it was not, you know, their number one, two, or three issue. That might be changing now that Roe is really, you know, in jeopardy. But the kind of like structural basics here is that, you know, the court is mainly has power to overturn laws, and Congress mainly has power to make laws. And so if you're conservative who wants less laws, less government, then the courts are going to be kind of a more favorable venue for you. But, you know, I think there's one person who is the audience for this that probably Joe Biden and a lot of Democrats are hoping are listening to Mitch McConnell's comments, who's Justice Breyer. You know, I think there's a lot of Democrats who very quietly are thinking, or not so quietly, well, boy, now would be a great time for you to retire and get that seat open, you know, while there's still a possibility to confirm a new nominee, or else we could end up in an all too familiar situation that we have been in now with McConnell holding that seat hostage.
Jeff, what about that? I mean, it hasn't been so quiet. I saw somewhere last week there was a crowd that was chanting, Breyer, retire, Breyer, retire.
And if he doesn't fill it, that's – and you wind up with eight justices. Now you have – excuse me. Now you have a real, real conservative majority with –
I think it would be seven, right, if there were another conservative on there, right? Now there's six, if you count Roberts.
Right. So right? it would be 6-2 with an eight justice court in the meantime.
Oh, got it. Yeah. Right.
Which is, let's say you have an eight justice court for potentially 2 years. That's really significant in terms of how it might affect the rulings.
Yeah. And again, it seems to me that if that doesn't motivate Democrats to get out and vote, what would? But as Alex says, that hasn't always proven true in the past. Before we end up our discussion of the issues and get into your favorite stories of the week, I'd like to get each of you your take on what we now hear more and more about, this phrase, critical race theory, CRT, they're even calling it. It even became an issue this week in the Southern Baptist Convention down in Nashville. One of the leaders for president that was accused of teaching CRT in his diocese or in his church. Critical race theory, what the hell is it? And is it really a viable political issue? Pema, you want to start us off? Each of you, give us your take on it.
Well, it's certainly a viable political issue because they're really running with it. You know, I think there was a survey recently from Media Matters, which is a left-leaning watchdog, and they found that, you know, in the last 3 months, Fox News has mentioned this new boogeyman like 1,300 times or something. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and they kind of, this is, you know, one of these things where they're just like, we're going to gin up fear over something and get people all upset about it. And I mean, look, one of the things that they get people all upset about is race and like what we're teaching children. So yeah, it's kind of like the perfect storm for them to sort of be able to freak out, you know, conservative viewers. And I think as to what is critical race theory, I think on some level, like the point is that it's hard to define, right? Because then anything can be critical race theory, right? Anything can be, you know, this dangerous ideology that, you know, that white people aren't as good and always haven't been as good as we like to believe. You know, that our country may have some systemic problems with race that continue to shape our society. And, you know, those are ideas that they want you to think are scary, and that will destroy the country. And so that's sort of this like amorphous cloud of fear that I think is certainly, you know, politically viable for as long as they want to make that into a boogeyman and talk about that instead of, you know, actual policy concerns.
At the same time, Jeff, isn't it just basically accepting the fact that there's a lot of built-in racism in this in the history of this country that we cannot deny and just sort of have to acknowledge?
Well,
or is that too naive?
Critical race theory is essentially a catch-all term for these a set of academic theories that posit on one level or another that race should be central to whatever you're discussing. And there's gradations of it, of course. You know, some academics would have this, you can't talk about anything without talking about race. Mm-hmm. And some of it is a little more subtle than that. As a political issue, I wish I could credit them properly. I don't remember who wrote it, but someone wrote that this was just like the Sharia law scare of 5 years ago. Remember this?
You know, yes.
Sharia law has just been declared in Dayton, Ohio, and Dubuque, Iowa, and your town is next. You're going to be burned at the stake. But I also get why Republicans are doing it, because it smells like a political winner. The Democrats are now starting to turn in a lot of their after action reports, from the 2020 elections, their autopsies. And I've seen two or three of these, and they all, each one of them makes the point that all the talk of defunding the police, socialism, et cetera, all made a difference, that it did motivate independent voters to swing away from Democrats in the waning days of the race. Republicans certainly recognize that, and they think that this is a viable issue like that they can run with.
Have you done any polling on this, Alex? Have you seen any polling that critical race theory really cuts through as a winning political issue?
I haven't. It's a good question. I would guess that, you know, basically any polling from more than, I don't know, a month ago, you would have a huge majority of people who had just no familiarity with that term and wouldn't really have an opinion on it. I think it's gained a lot of salience very recently, but I don't think it's a general election issue. I think it's a primary issue for Republicans. I mean, it's about the base, not about, you know, winning the diminishing number of swing voters. The Sharia law is a great comparison. It also reminds me of the Common Core freakout moment around the Tea Party kind of era. And I think all of this stuff, you know, you're talking about education, kids, it's very emotional, it's very personal, and it reflects the moment that you're in. So in the Tea Party era, it was all about the federal government and, you know, too much spending and central control. That was a kind of libertarian inflected moment. And so this idea of Common Core, which was that the federal government was going to set standards and, you know, override local control, that was the big kind of conservative fear at the time. Now it's all about race and Black Lives Matter and making white people feel bad, essentially. So critical race theory is the big thing. But it's ironic. I mean, some of these bills that are being introduced in school boards or in state legislatures, you know, we've spent several years now talking about cancel culture and how it's run amok and free speech. Yeah. And these bills are literally criminalizing the teaching of, you know, things. And the way they're written, it's pretty vague. It's like you can't talk about, you know, racial problems in the past. There was this, even a proposal to put body cameras in classrooms to make sure that teachers aren't teaching critical race theory on the sly. So, I think that I always come back to the psychology of this stuff. And I think this is about people are uncomfortable learning this. They don't want to learn this stuff and they don't want their kids to be exposed to it. They would rather live in what Ta-Nehisi Coates called the dream, and so just don't tell me la la la, I'm going to plug my ears and pretend it's not real.
What an age we live in. Teachers are forced to wear a body camera and carry a gun. Both, right, in the classroom. There you go. Pema Levy from Mother Jones, Jeff Dufour, National Journal, Alex Seitzwald, NBC News. Thank you. Thank you so much for a great survey of the news of the week. Before we let you go, with everything we're covering, there's always at least one story that makes you stop dead in your tracks and say, oh, my God, look at that. This is great. This is funny. This is sad. Your favorite story of the week. Jeff, let's start off with you.
Dennis Kucinich.
He's back, right?
The one-time boy mayor of Cleveland wants another shot more than 40 years later. Remember, he led the city into default last time he was mayor, which is when he was in his early 30s. And he got crushed in the Ohio gubernatorial primary a couple years back. But no matter, he wants the job again. And I have a theory, Bill. It has something to do with the UFOs. Kucinich, of course, you may remember, used to hang out with Shirley MacLaine.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
MacLaine revealed in her book that the Ohio congressman, Kucinich, had seen a UFO and felt, quote, a connection in his heart and heard directions in his mind, unquote. So my theory is that he has received a sign from his alien overlords, and it is time to act.
Dennis, call home. is he actually running? He said running. I hadn't seen that.
He's running for mayor.
Oh my God! There you go, Pema. Top that if you can.
that's pretty good. I don't mean to go back to the critical race theory discussion, but there was a really great story on it. That I recommend from NBC News called Critical Race Theory Battles Invade School Boards with help from conservative groups. But really it's this fascinating story about what happened in Maine when a parent decided that this was being taught in his schools and was basically going to troll the school board and get Tucker Carlson involved. And it really kind of shows how this is like this completely like bogus, but like, also very intentionally manufactured and well-funded sort of campaign to get local communities riled up over this issue. It's really sort of a fascinating dive into what's happening. So if our conversation intrigued you, I encourage you to go follow up and read that story.
Well, that's a good follow-up to what we talked about. How about you, Alex?
Well, first of all, thank you to Pema for promoting NBC. Now I feel bad. It is a great story. I will second that. The thing that I was going to mention, though, is what I think is just a good thing for the world, hopefully, which is that the Ford F-150 Lightning, that's the electric pickup truck, they have more than 100,000 reservations for that already. So you can pay. It's $100 refundable deposit. It just kind of puts you place online that the truck isn't coming out till next year. But I think it's a really interesting, I don't know that Ford is doing that. You know, this is the best-selling vehicle of the past like 30 years. Yeah. It's the best-selling truck of the past 50 years. And if you can win over pickup truck drivers to electric vehicles, that's your most skeptical audience. You know, if you can win them over and you can get the best-selling vehicle of all time, I think you go a huge way towards electrifying the American, auto fleet. So I think that's just cool. I think it's a cool truck. I think it's a great product. And I've worked construction jobs. I know people who drive pickup trucks, and like, they like gadgets, they like cool things. And if you can just offer them a better product, I think you can get a lot of those people to switch.
I think that's great news. And remember, Joe Biden drove that truck, right? And what did he say? This sucker's fast or something like that. Indeed. Well, I have to tell you, what stopped me this week was reading, in a sense, no surprise, but my favorite story was seeing that Jared Kushner has a book deal. He's got a book deal with a conservative publisher named Broadside. A new book in which the publisher says, and Kushner says, I find this almost laugh out loud funny. He is going to tell the truth about the Trump White House. I think that's sort of an oxymoron.
For a change.
oxymoron, right? Truth about the Trump White House. But what really made the story come alive is you can imagine, the Twitter response. I'm sure some of you have seen it. Someone called Jared Kushner an emerging fiction writer, which I liked. Someone else asked whether a box of crayons came with each book or you had to buy that separately. And then there are a lot of people who were, wondering what the title of, as yet unnamed, the title of the book would be. My favorite was Staring into Space, a Full-Time Job. And remember seeing the pictures of Jared Kushner. That's exactly what he looked like at any rate. So check it out. Jared Kushner will not be a guest on the Bill Press Pod. I can guarantee you that. But I want to thank you again, Pema Levy, Mother Jones, Jeff Duper, The National Journal, and Alex Seitzwald from MSNBC and NBC News. And thank all the rest of you for listening. It's good to have you with us today. Heat wave out there, so try to stay cool and stay safe. And then come back and see us on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod next Tuesday. We're going to be talking to CNN's Don Lemon about his new book, Addressing Racism in America, how to acknowledge it, how to deal with it. His new book called This Is the Fire. That's next Tuesday on the Bill Press Pod. Again, take care of yourself. Come back and see us next Tuesday on the next edition of the Bill Press Pod.